Tonight on Arena, Denise Chaila and Piers Doherty tell us about songs from an empty room, and Marty Ray and Katrina Daly on making theatre in a time of COVID. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Lisa McHugh, Gavin James, Jafara Sirka Richardson and Denise Chaila are among the many artists taking part in a series of concerts called Songs from an Empty Room. The concerts, which take place this weekend, will be broadcast live on RTE2 television and on RTE2 FM, as well as they will be available on the RTE player. The empty rooms in the title refers to the fact that venues like the Olympia Theatre in Dublin, Cypress Avenue in Cork, Dolan's in Limerick, INEC in Killarney and Roisin Dubh in Galway will have no audience present, just the artist and the empty room in front of them. And the organisers hope to raise funds for two charities supporting performers and artists whose livelihoods have been decimated by the cancellation of pretty much all concerts and festivals in 2020. We'll find out lots more about that in a moment because we will be talking to event organiser and former Saw Doctor Piers Doherty, and also to a Limerick-based singer, performance poet, rapper and grime artist called... Well, I'm not going to tell you what she's called. She can tell you herself.
It's not Chile, it's not Chilala. Not hard pill to swallow. Chile or Chilea, Chia, Chila, Chila, that's not my name. Say my name.
Denise Chaila is her name, and she is one of the artists, as I said, performing at this weekend's series of concerts called Song from an Empty Room. We'll be talking to her shortly, I believe. We're having some difficulty just making the final connection, but I do have Piers Doherty with me at the moment. Well, he's in our Galway studio, in fact. Piers, former Saw Doctor and one of the organisers of this particular set of gigs. It's become the thing of 2020, hasn't it? Songs to an empty room, literally. We've had it in a few different forms at this stage, Piers. People literally singing out to nothing, as yes. In nobody sitting in a concert hall in front of them or in a venue in front of them, but everybody, everything happening online. It's very odd.
It's very odd. I saw Denise performing on The Courage, The Other Voices Courage from the National Gallery. Very impressed, but for a performer to perform without an audience... And for to experience that at home, it's a new world, really. Mm. Lots of people experimenting with new venues and new ways of approaching how to express themselves. And nobody knows when we're going to get back to what we love to do as performers, as promoters and as audiences, which is enjoy the room.
I'm even thinking of back in your days with the Saw Doctors, Piers. Can you envisage of... You know, the vibe, the feeling at a Saw Doctors gig was such a sense of community. It was such a sense of celebration if you were lucky enough to see you guys play live. Could you envisage that band playing to an empty room in the fashion that the artists will be doing this weekend?
You could play to it, but it would not be the same. I mean, we used to play to the back of the hall, and the idea was that we were one together. The people paid to come and see us, and we gave it all. And yeah, I mean, you brought the crowd along with you. You can't remove that glint in the eye when a singer is singing their song for the first time and the audience gets it and they respect it, or when a comedian delivers that punchline and the laugh happens, or the theatre performance where the crowd are just moved together. You know, it's, and like, we've got a hand that I've been following Little John Lee doing his Shed, the Wildaways in Galway, doing their stuff, and everybody's out there trying to find where it's going to land. But it's very, very difficult to, you know, replace that sweat, replace the, you know, squeeze together, celebrating together. I don't know where it's going to end, but I mean, this is our attempt to try and deal with that, you know, so that's...
Well, yeah. We have Denise. We have Denise now, and I've seen, in fact, a couple of different performances by you, Denise. And great to have you on the phone at this point. I've seen a couple of performances where you've had to, where you've been performing to the empty room. The Other Voices performance of the song I played, in fact, at the beginning of it, Chaila. I made sure to listen 45 times. Although you do know, you don't tell us in the song how to pronounce it.
No, I do that deliberately. It's more fun that way.
Yeah, you tell us how not to pronounce it. But when you performed in the National Gallery, which was one of these gigs done to in essentially an empty room, or when you performed at the Other Voices Courage, which is again was essentially done to an empty room, that was you've had this experience of sending out a performance with not necessarily, well, certainly no live response coming back. What does it feel like?
Well, I think it feels like an extension of a conversation with yourself in the shower for me, you know, because your music, or my music rather, is written and made with a few friends and kind of in isolation anyway. And so the joy of performance really is about entering into a conversation with people where you can see like visceral change, and they communicate with you what they're feeling as you share. And I think there's an intimidating thing about sort of hitting a blank wall and sort of like being afraid that it's just going to fall on deaf ears because you don't have the same connection. Mm. You don't have the same sort of like community. And for me, it was like both. It was kind of like a double-edged sword. I mean, on one hand, perhaps I rely too much on the responses of others to make me feel safe and secure in that. And so it taught me something. And yet, on the other hand, this is, it's not why I did music, you know. If I wanted to perform into emptiness, I'd run into a cave somewhere, and that would be what my music is about, you know.
What about the type of feedback? And I'm sure there's been very positive feedback, particularly on the Other Voices performance. What about when you get that? I know it's after the event, or possibly there are some responses that are passed on to you as the thing is actually going out online. Does that help in any way, or can you take those on board as you're performing?
It's not the same as watching someone's expression change. I will say that. It's not the same as the sort of very sincere impact that you can see you have on someone, or you don't, if the gig is going terribly. And I think that gauge is really what's missing. For me, watching comments come up on a screen can be fun, and it's certainly a different kind of skill, but it also presents another world of anxiety before you go on stage, because you have to read and things go quickly, and am I answering this well enough? And it feels almost like a combination of like of an interview plus a performance.
Yeah.
And that's really odd. It's very strange.
Yeah, because while you might get reviews in the press subsequent to a gig, If you're getting a nasty comment, and let's face it, there are those who kind of online who thrive on the nasty comments.
Absolutely,
I'm sure they are there,
and
that they come through. It's like getting a review while you're singing. Now that takes a lot of guts and a lot of self confidence to push that to one side and say, no, you know what, I've got to do what I'm doing here, and I don't care about those responses.
Yeah, it was really apt that series was named Courage, because I was in my head telling myself not to falter, because when you enter a new arena because of course music is such a vulnerable thing, right? It's the performance and the act of vulnerability that you bear yourself before the world, and you say, hey, this is what I'm giving, this is what I'm speaking, this is me. I wrote these in the privacies and the intimacies of my contained space, and I get to share that knowing that I am safely held by your attention. And the comments are lovely, and when they can be filtered, so I'm not receiving something brutal mid-flow, that's always nice. But if something slips through the cracks and hits me across the head, the process of care in the middle of a show to recover from something that I've read is like extremely difficult, especially because I've got a lot of lyrics. You know, so I'm already remembering a lot of words, and I'm reading a lot of words in front of me, and it's just very complex, actually.
Yeah, and lots of your lyrics are provocative in that they are challenging in terms of their politics, in terms of their discussion of identity. So I'm sure those are precisely the types of lyrics that get very strong responses. I'm thinking of, I'm thinking of particularly of your, it's almost it's a spoken word piece, in fact, Dual Citizenship, where you address, and that's dual spelt D-U-E-L, where you address, how people have addressed your identity living in Limerick, but having been born in Zambia.
Yes, and it is like, it was something I had to deal with for the first time after Courage, was the duality and literally watching my two identities duke it out on the internet because some people were very, very offended to see me in the National Gallery. And some people were really warmed, and for them it presented a fulcrum, like a beacon of hope. And at the center of it, I was, you know, me, vulnerable post-gig, receiving a lot of feedback and genuinely quite nervous and vulnerable, you know, really, really scared, because whether it's effusive praise or scathing criticism, my dad always says it, you know, like, be careful how you take the praise, because then you'll have to take all of the criticism.
Yeah, treat both imposters the same way in some ways, success and failure. Absolutely. Or good critics, bad critics. You got to kind of treat both the same with the same.
Absolutely. But I think we all just have too much time to ourselves to read and to experience these shows through that lens. Because what else do we have if you don't have the thrill and the magic of the performance itself to carry you?
It's one of the things Piers Doherty, Piers is the organiser, obviously, or one of the organisers of the Songs from an Empty Room series that we're speaking about this evening. It's one of the things, you know, Denise is giving us a sense there of an immediate response and the immediate challenges. But of course, the long-term challenges here are enormous for artists who have no work, Piers, and who have had effectively no work since the beginning of this year and no sign of any work coming their way.
And the uncertainty is the danger. We've no idea where we're going with this. It's that uncertainty that leads to the stress. It leads to you question what you're doing. Am I going to keep doing this? You know, is there a future for me doing this? And it's that uncertainty that we're trying to deal with. I mean, Epic was formed to represent the interests and concerns of people in the business, the people behind the scenes, the non-funded sector, and the idea of Songs from an Empty Room. And like, we're so grateful for all the artists coming together and to Shinawil Productions and RTE and helping us facilitate this. But it came together to raise funds, so hopefully we'll have something in place to deal with this fallout, you know?
Yes, because that the plan is, if it's counselling and it's financial support for those who are really experiencing a difficulty at the moment. Yes. It would be remiss of me, Denise, before I finish up, not to mention the fact that both of your parents work as doctors, work in medicine. I don't know whether you heard on the news about the death of the doctor in the Mater Hospital from COVID, in fact. It must have, apart from the challenges around your career and around making music, it must have been very frightening on a personal basis to watch your parents going into work on a daily basis.
It was. And I really admire how much grace that they handled themselves with, because their general attitude is they chose this career. They chose it knowing the risks, and they chose to do this because their ultimate aim is to say, we want to help people and we want to essentially stand in the gap. And yet, you know, those are my parents. And so my primary concerns at the beginning of lockdown were really because, you know, they're in their 50s and vulnerable.
Yeah. As was the doctor who died was 59, and his daughter speaking on the news. It's absolutely heartbreaking to hear what the family have had to deal with in recent weeks.
But they did give me a practice of care. I think that it's a really beautiful thing to have come from the assurance, and they're both great at de-escalation and just framing things in a way that my siblings and I could digest, so we didn't lose ourselves in anxiety.
Yeah, and you certainly haven't lost yourself in anxiety in this second track that I want to finish up by playing. If there's any doubts about the Irish part of your identity, it's all over this song. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind Anseo.
Wow, so it was the first word I learned in Irish when I came in 2000 and started doing school.
Yeah, Denise Chyla.
Yeah.
Anseo.
Anseo.
And so that is what you have put into this song, that first word of Irish. Have you learned much since?
I've learned a lot. I've learned that chicken spice boxes and going down Centra and worrying about how you're going to get a taxi and like so many other things ascribe Irishness that aren't, you know, the staid, what language do you speak and what school did you go to? And, you know, culture and heritage is really dynamic. And I tried to infuse as much of that from every part of me as I could in the song.
All right. Well, it is all over the song. Thanks very much for speaking to us this evening. That's Denise Chyla and Piers Doherty. And I'll give further details out on the songs from Nenty Rube in just a moment. But have a listen to Denise before we do that.
You're Black James Bond.
I'm sure.
Spice Box Taxi by the Central.
I'm sure.
Sailor Moon remix by Fela.
Say what?
I am not a queen.
I'm a pharaoh.
I'm Black James Bond.
I'm sure.
Spice Box Taxi by the Central.
I'm sure.
Sailor Moon remix by Fela.
Say what?
Yes, wonderful energy indeed there from Denise Chyla and that live performance of her song On Shop. And Denise, along with many of those other artists I mentioned to you, taking part in the event at the weekend called Songs from an Empty Room, broadcast live on RTÉ2 television and RTÉ2 FM on the radio this Saturday between 8:30 p.m. and 10:45 p.m. And the show will also be available on the RTÉ player. And I mentioned during that chat with Denise about the death that we heard on the news there about of Dr. Syed Waqar Ali, and obviously our thoughts and sympathies with his family this evening. During the past few months, Fishamble Theatre Company challenged people in Ireland and further afield to write 600-word plays. A selection of submitted works will now be presented online this Friday, the 24th of July at 7 p.m, hence 24/7. They're a combination of pieces performed on the O'Reilly Theatre stage and filmed and multimedia pieces created digitally. The project employed more than 50 arts workers. Martyrs by Katrina Daly was one of those pieces selected. It has a mother and son, played by Eleanor Methven, the mother, Marty Ray, the son, who are confronting alcoholism while cocooning. Marty Ray is with me here in studio, and Katrina Daly, the playwright, is joining us down the line. Katrina, what was it that inspired you to take this particular angle on, you know, cocooning and lockdown, the alcohol side of it, because it's important in the story?
Yeah, I suppose I had to cocoon myself for a bit, and what I found really uncomfortable was having to quantify everything I wanted to consume for a week and then hand the list over to my parents. And there was something about it that felt very revealing. And I suppose I kind of felt, if that's revealing for me, for somebody who has an addiction, it must be really... Really difficult and awkward, both for the person they're handing the list over to and for them themselves.
And I don't want to be peering into your own business, but yet I have to ask the question anyway. were there particular items, you know, that you're happy to share with us that you thought, I'd really rather not be asking my parents to get that for me?
I don't know. I suppose for me, like, I don't know about yourself now, Sean, but like, I'd very rarely count up how many glasses of wine I'd have in a week, but there was something about having to kind of stock up for a week, because we couldn't just pop out to the shop.
Yeah.
That meant I really kind of had to face how much cheese I was consuming and how much wine and kind of the stuff that maybe is better in moderation, I suppose.
Yeah, so you found yourself counting and getting to a number that you didn't want to get to, essentially. Was that it?
Exactly.
Marty Ray sitting in front of me. Did you dare send anybody to the shop for X bottles of wine or anything like that, Marty? I won't ask you how many bottles, by the way, Katrina. I'll leave that to your own privacy.
Very good.
No, but I never thought about food as much in my life as I have done the past few months. Like the dinner every day. What will we do for the dinner? What will we get for the dinner? It's become the kind of staple conversation. The one thing that happens in anyone's day for ages was the dinner. But it was nice to work on the piece because of that. The whole idea that I hadn't thought about, really. People in that kind of older age bracket who were suddenly, their kind of agency was taken away from them. And having to kind of, people knowing their business as much as they did, you know. Well, somebody wants to do something privately or whatever, you know, their own business, and all of a sudden people are kind of helping but wanting to know, do you really need more than the three that we agreed on or whatever, you know? And you get into hot water then.
I had an experience outside a chemist where, and I wasn't going for anything in particularly that I would be embarrassed about, but as I was standing outside, the person who was giving the hand just said, what are you getting inside? And I thought, well, I don't really want to shout out loud that I'm getting a prescription for whatever it was, you know, but suddenly you kind of, well, that's kind of private.
Totally.
And then you felt you were being awkward. So the story that you're telling here then, Katrina, it's the mother and the son. The son is doing the shopping for the mother. Is she the one with the issue around the numbers of bottles of wine?
So she basically, the kind of premise is that he's been doing her shopping, but he catches her coming out of the supermarket when he's going in to do his own shopping one day. And so she's left the house, even though she's not supposed to. And what he finds her with is kind of, I suppose it's disturbing to him.
It does bring up, though, an interesting aspect of all of this, which is the son-mother, the child-parent dynamic. The parent gets older and the child starts to take control. I believe that Eleanor Methven, who plays the character of the mother, had some issues around the type of control that perhaps your character, Alan, was exerting.
Marty. I mean, I dare anyone to try and control Eleanor Methven doing anything.
I'm sure she was speaking for her character now, not about herself.
Of course she was. But yeah, and she's right. I mean, the whole idea of... my character isn't... There isn't... That's actually the interesting thing about the piece is that there's no person in the right or a person in the wrong. My character seems to be taking a kind of a moral high ground about, we agreed on this, we said about this, but it's definitely his opinion of what she's doing isn't necessarily correct or the proper thing to be doing. So he's putting his own judgment on her, but at the same time helping her. So she's in a difficult situation of, I can't say what I feel or I can't say what I want because I need to rely on this person. And when she decides to do it on her own and goes out, she gets in trouble because she's of that age that should be cocooning and shouldn't be outside. So all those tiny difficulties.
Yes.
And then you add a family relationship in there and sure.
Yeah.
Then fireworks.
It's interesting though, Katrina, because it is quite a task. Well, it seems like quite a task to write a 600 word play, which is precisely what these tiny plays are all about. You know, short, swift, brief, to the point. Did you find it hard to because even as you both have spoken to me, there's a lot of dynamic at play in over those 600 words. I think it's maybe 3 or 4 printed pages, you know, in total. Yeah. Did you find yourself compressing things, or did it just fit the form that you had to use?
I have to be honest. I'd love to tell you it was a struggle because I think it could be a struggle, but there was something about this story that I had that just kind of fell very naturally together. I actually think it's, for a writer, I think it's more difficult to write a 600 word piece than it is to write a 6,000 word piece. You know, it's all about the compression of everything and getting enough in there to lure people in, but, you know, not so, and just the balance is tough, you know.
Wasn't it? I think it was Shaw who said to Churchill about writing a long letter, he said, I'm sorry I've written you such a long letter, I didn't have time to write a short one, you know.
So exactly.
Obviously it's the same type of thing here. For the actor then, looking at that, when you look at 600 words, it sounds like so little, Marty, but did you find that within that very short space of time there was a huge dynamic offering itself?
Yeah. Well, you're dealing with a mother and a son, you're going to have that. So that's a kind of a gift immediately, so that the two actors can, you know, you can extrapolate from what you have in the page and said kind of, you can kind of fill in little gaps. And we had Katrina there as well to say it was, no, that's a bit too much. Or yes, absolutely. You could go down that line. You could have that history, that background. So myself and Eleanor had kind of chats around about that. So you're walking into the piece with 40 odd years of experience between the two people before they even start to speak, which is great. And you can play that, you know, you can have that in even a look, even before you've spoken. And the thing that I liked about the length of them, those little 600 word pieces, it's like, it reminded me of, you know, when you're in the train and or in the Dart or anything, and you're going past all the backs of people's houses and you look in and you see the lights are all on in the evening. And it's like you get 2 minutes in somebody's kitchen, then you get 2 minutes of a story and somebody's standing in a room doing something. You see all these little flashes of life through the COVID, because a lot of them are kind of about the COVID experience.
A lot of the plays, a lot of the training plays.
Yeah, I think so. So that's kind of, it was like these little snapshots you know, yeah. And I like that about them.
Was that inevitable, Katrina, that I think a large portion of the plays that will be shown as part of Tiny Plays 24/7, the Fish Amble project this year, a lot of them do centre around cocooning or COVID or people being, I suppose, confined in a small space together, which is great for drama. Was it inevitable for you that COVID would be present?
Not really. And if you look at the 10 pieces that have been selected, there's some of them that have nothing to do with the pandemic at all, yeah. Which is really nice. I suppose for me, again, because it was kind of influenced by something I was going through personally, that's why I probably wrote about it. But I would actually normally find it very difficult to respond to something like a pandemic this quickly.
Yeah.
I've been really impressed with all the writers who've managed to come out with stuff about it, because it's something I think we'll be processing for years, really. So yeah.
And what about the logistics of all of this, Marty? I'm wondering, how did you rehearse? How did you do the piece? Because I mentioned in the introduction that some of the pieces are done on the stage of Belvedere, isn't it? Of the O'Reilly Theatre in Belvedere, and some of them are done as digital. They're put together, digitally put together afterwards. How was your piece done?
Ours was one of the ones that was filmed live in the O'Reilly stage, which is a lovely idea, because it's to have that kind of theatre. I think you can, when Jim Cullerton, who was directing them, he was kind of saying, you'll see a bit of the rig of the lighting rig, and you'll see the curtains kind of close behind us and we're on the stage. Mm. So there's a feeling of the theatre on, you know, actors back in their natural habitat kind of a thing as things come back to life. But on the floor of it, we had like a white tape grid, and each kind of square of the grid was a metre. So we knew what 2 metres away from each other was and what 1 metre away from each other was. And so the staging was kind of based around that.
So you knew if you were standing in one box that you had, there had to be at least a box, or yeah, the most of 2 boxes between you and wherever Eleanor was standing.
Exactly.
So you would work the blocking that way. And I guess that brings up a whole dynamic in itself, you know.
It does, yeah. Well, there's a tension to me. Yeah, there's kind of a tension immediately.
Because you can't get close to each other. So there's a standoff almost from the outside.
Yeah. And when the piece is about COVID-19 anyways, that adds a realistic kind of colour to it, because, you know, we weren't allowed to be hugging each other and stuff like that, when, especially with older members.
So what, I mean, this is the specifics of what you've been dealing with on this project, but what about theatre in general and where we're headed? I mean, I don't know if you heard me speaking with Denise Child and Peter Staherty about the songs from an empty room project. Yeah. We have singers, musicians playing out to empty spaces. You can't really do that in theatre, or can you?
But I mean, this is the thing, like, you know, what's the saying, necessity is the mother of invention. Mm. You know, that things will come out, new ideas and new thinking will come out of any kind of situation that's thrown at you. And it all might look a bit odd for a while, you know, it will, I think, as we all get used to it. I think Brian Friel said something along the lines of, a play is never finished until actors speak it. And also a play isn't finished, or production isn't finished, until people sit in front of it and watch it. And that there's that kind of go-between, that energetic go-between between the viewers and the performers. So that's a really important part of what we do. And we've been doing it for a long, 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 long time, for hundreds of years. So I don't think we'll lose that element of it. I don't think this stuff is going to beat so much of what makes us, us. And I think that element of going to see live storytelling is a massive part of what we are. And I don't think it's going to stop.
What about from the writer's point of view, Katrina? I mean, the cliche is, well, sure, it's easy for a writer. You're generally doing your own thing in your own room by yourself anyway. So
I socially distance anyway. So.
And did you find lockdown and all of that period then, did you find it productive, or could you work at all?
I actually found it very productive. I think I'm one of the few, because I can totally understand why a lot of people were really stumped with it. But I'm very lucky. I've people like Fish Amble supporting me, and particularly with something like this, where they've kind of hired so many people for this particular project. It's just been great. But I suppose now's the time, certainly, to be putting into to be putting your money into developing good plays and good performances for the future, because at least us writers can do that in a socially distant manner. So it's been okay for me, but a tough time nonetheless.
Not so really for the actor, Marty. I would have thought one man shows, there's not that many of them, and we want more than one man or one woman on the stage, don't we?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I can act away in my living room if I want, and often do.
But some of my best performances
nobody saw. But I think we'll all get used to the situation. I think we'll kind of, you know, navigate it and get used to it, and we'll be flocking to see stuff.
Well, so, okay. Well, there's an optimism there, but what the practicalities of it will be, we have yet to see. Well, thanks to both of you for speaking to us, Marty for coming in and Katrina for joining us on the phone. And Tiny Plays 24/7, it will be available to view online this Friday, 24th of July, at 7 o'clock. Don't dare go near it until 8, when this programme is over. You can register to watch at eventbrite.ie and search for Tiny Plays, or go to fishamble.com for further details. And that's Whipping Boy with Twinkle, bringing us to almost 13 and a half minutes to 8 o'clock on Wednesday night's arena. A Traveller at the Gates of Wisdom is the latest book from John Boyne. It's published by Doubleday. And here is John Boyne himself reading from the opening of the book.
A Traveller at the Gates of Wisdom, Chapter 1, Palestine, AD 1. On the night that I was born, my father Marinus left our home while my mother was in labour, and over the 8 hours that followed, slaughtered a dozen infant boys, the sons of our neighbours and friends, each one under the age of 2 years. He owned 4 swords, including a pair of gladii and an ornamental sika that had been handed down through 3 generations of our family, but he chose the smallest weapon in his arsenal, a triangular dagger with a wooden handle and silver blade, known as a parazonium, to end each of the baby's lives. A ruby jewel of considerable value lay at the centre of the quillion, its liquid blush ready to reflect the blood that spilled from the bodies of the children. A man of duty, he did not hesitate as he marched from door to door, searching each house for hidden nurslings, before plunging his knife into the heart of every boy he found. And while mothers screamed in horror and rained curses down upon his head, fathers stood silently in corners, mute and impotent, knowing that if they dared to speak, the blade would surely find its way across their throats before their sentence came to an end. Older siblings trembled in fear as they watched Marinus go about his dark business, soiling themselves, frightened that they, too, were about to face the judgment of the gods for some unspecified crime. But no, once the babe had been dispatched from this world for the next, my father barely glanced in the direction before making his way to the next house, and the next after that, for there were more babies to discover and more lives to bring to a premature end. After each murder, he wiped the blade clean on his tunic, the fabric growing increasingly discoloured as the sun began to peep over the horizon in the east, a fiery witness to unspeakable crimes, and soon the grey disappeared beneath an incarnadine coat. Of course, Marinus was not the only man engaged in bloody misadventures that night. More than 30 other soldiers had been deployed by King Herod to the towns that surrounded Bethlehem, from Ramat Rachel in the north to Rafida in the south, until more than 300 infant boys were put to death for the crime of being a potential king of the Jews. When my father returned home in the early morning, his spirit died with a barbaric tint that could never be erased. I was suckling at my mother's breast, and he placed a trembling hand upon my skull, resting it there for a moment as he gave me his blessing and begged forgiveness from the immortals atop Mount Olympus. When he took it away, a trace of blood was left in its wake, a deadly deposit. And I've always wondered whether some residue of his crimes remained indelibly upon my soul. A tattoo invisible to all but the eyes of the gods. A reminder of the massacre of the innocents that was taking place as I filled my lungs with air for the first time.
John Boyne there reading the opening chapter of his new book, A Traveller at the Gates of Wisdom, published by Doubleday. We'll be reviewing that book. Mary McGill will be reviewing it for us on next Tuesday's Arena. And coming up after this break, we'll be speaking about Emma Donoghue's latest book, The Pull of the Stars. At a time when publishers everywhere have been postponing publication of their new novels, Emma Donoghue's latest book, The Pull of the Stars, comes out this week, months ahead of its original publication date of spring 2021. No prizes for guessing why, however. The story unfolds over three intense days in a Dublin hospital during the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. Three women are thrown together in a tiny makeshift ward. Nurse Julia Power, young volunteer called Bridie Sweeney, and Dr. Kathleen Lynn, a fictional version of the real-life activist and nationalist who took part in the Easter Rising. Sophie Gorman has been reading Emma Donoghue's latest book and she joins me now. You couldn't make it up that Emma Donoghue was writing this book about the 1918 flu before there was any talk about COVID-19, I heard her saying, Sophie.
It is impossibly timely and prescient. You have to wonder, did Emma know something that the rest of us didn't? And what is, I suppose, incredibly remarkable about this is the similarities of the Dublin then and the Dublin now and the way that we respond to a pandemic now and that people responded to a pandemic then. The Spanish flu was an airborne disease transmitted by coughing and sneezing. It attacks the lungs. It sneaks up on you. It attacks everybody differently. Some people have very mild attacks, like Julia Parra, the nurse that you mentioned at the beginning. Hmm. Some others are dead in hours in front of you. It sounds incredibly familiar because it is very familiar. And it is, reading it right now in the middle of our own pandemic, it's impossible not to connect with it instantly. You have people, situations like people on the tram recoiling when somebody coughs, and then people have to wear masks. It's very much of the here and now, even though it is, as you say, from 102 years ago that she is writing about. And she was writing about it, actually, she was inspired to write it because in 2018, when she started writing it, it was the centenary of the Spanish flu. So that obviously was what pushed it, put the idea in her head. And then obviously everything changed this year in March when she delivered the final draft to the publishers. Our own pandemic was engulfing us, so they decided, yes, to push it forward.
Although it was a first draft that she delivered to the publisher, so I'm just wondering about what adjustments she might have made subsequent to that. But let's put that to the one side for the time being and get a little bit more of a sense of what's actually going on in the novel. It's essentially the interaction between these three women that's important. Julia Power, the young nurse that we mentioned, first of all, she turns 30, I think, doesn't she, during the course of the three days of the book.
It's only always said over 3 days. And she I have to say, I really like this when Emma Donoghue does this. She delivers the narrative in the first person. It's her voice that we hear. It's a bit like in Room, we have the young boy and the wonder, we have Liv, who's also we had another nurse. And in this one, Julia Power is our narrator, and she turns 30 during the course of this, and she was unmarried, which at that time was quite old to be unmarried. So you had people commenting on your life the whole time. She's somebody who was weary with her years. She's a nurse. She's a junior nurse, but she's often propelled into much more senior roles because of the staff shortages that she experiences. And she's running a ward called the Maternity Fever Ward for expectant mothers who have the double whammy that they're also infected with the flu just as they're about to give birth. It's not a ward in any traditional sense, but it's probably a ward that many people are facing right now, because it was a supplies closet until the hospital ran out of space and then had to create new wards. And she's running it. She's now the senior nurse on this ward because she only has a handful of patients, thankfully, because there's only a small space. But into this space enters Bridie Sweeney, as you mentioned, who's a bright young thing, a bit of a whippersnapper. But she is somebody who was an orphan. She lives in the convent. She's had a very limited education. It's been quite a brutal one, as we learn through the book. And she's just a volunteer. She's never been in the hospital before. Julia, her initial reaction to this young creature who comes into her ward is slightly hesitant because she worries she took it under her feet. But then what we learn, which is interesting, and there's a beautiful friendship that develops between them, that Julia is very lonely and Julia loves this young woman who comes in and is open and eager and wants to help. And they form a very sweet bond quite quickly. And I mean, the book is set over 3 days, so obviously it has to happen quite quickly. But it is a very true bond that they form.
Another very interesting aspect of the Bridie Sweeney aspect for me was the fact that obviously we're talking about 1918 here, and we're talking about the Spanish flu and how things kind of transfer from today back to then. But a lot of the incidents of the brutality that Bridie experienced as a, you know, in the various institutions where she grew up, a lot of those were taken from the 2009 Ryan report.
That's exactly it. But that's what Emma Donoghue does so wonderfully, particularly with historical books, is her research is incredible and it's so assiduous. And she went through all of the Ryan report and found these details, and we have them. But they're not delivered to us in the book in a very kind of educational way. They're delivered to us just in very minimal ways, like, not to skip ahead, but towards the end, we learned that really Bridie has been brutalized all over her body, and that's delivered just as a small detail, a key detail, but you don't feel that you're being lectured to in any way about her background, and she's somebody who, although she comes from that background, she's just so happy to be in this new space and to learn, and you do feel obviously the remorse of somebody whose life never had a chance because she just went through that schooling and was controlled by the religious. There's a religious and a nun who is also a sister working in the hospital, and we know that she has dominated this poor young girl's life and her fellow nuns, and so there is a truth to it, not, as I say, in a kind of a hectoring way that it's delivered.
And where does Dr. Kathleen Lynn fit into the story then? Because she is a real life character.
And I think that because she was a real life character, that we learned the least about her. But I think, like we should all be, I think Emma Donoghue was slightly enthralled by her, this suffragette nationalist activist who fought in the Easter Rising, was arrested. And as we know, in real life, she set up a free clinic in Dublin. She came back after being in Britain, she came back here and then to Ireland, and she set up a free clinic. And then ultimately she founded a children's hospital. She's a remarkable character, and so we meet her, and she's somebody who comes in. She arrives in the hospital. It's a very rainy day, and one of the gossipy orderlies describes her as a vicar's daughter from Mayo who has gone astray, which is a wonderful
bit of Irish judgment there,
life into a phrase. but there are lots of rumors about who she might be going around the hospital, but she's very practical, and she comes in and she's an enabler, which I suspect she probably was in real life, because she comes in and she tells Julia instantly that Julia must use her own initiative and does what, you know, there's this kind of this hierarchy that she dismisses in the hospital, that she realizes in these situations, you have to just act on instinct.
To what extent do you think, obviously all the talk about this Emma Donoghue book is around, you know, the pandemic now and the Spanish flu of 1918, but to what extent do you think that Emma Donoghue's original intention here was to talk to us about women, their experience in Irish society and in Irish institutions, and the female body? Because setting it in a maternity ward obviously brings us into a physicality and a physical description of the female body in a way that other venues mightn't, or situations mightn't.
Oh, well, and Emma Donoghue certainly doesn't shirk back from dealing with the physicality of it. There's one particular moment when Julia is forced to manually remove the afterbirth from a hemorrhaging new mother, and her previous experience is only on an orange, and she gamely goes for it, and Emma Donoghue describes it as reaching into a cave behind a waterfall, hot red past the gloves, all the way up my arm. So there's no attempt to prettify the brutality of childbirth. But I think this novel, actually, though, yes, you're absolutely right. This is not about the pandemic. This is about people coming together. And actually what it's also about is caring. Because Julia, she's very much a caregiver. Now, we focus a lot now, obviously, on people on the front line. But she cares also for her brother, Tim, who's come back from the war, because obviously this is also at the time of the war. He's come back mute from the war. He's apparently suffering from something called war neurosis. And it's about caring for each other. And the structure of it with these three women, and particularly with the two, Julia and Bridie, and also the patients, is that they form a bond. Right. And they get it's that closeness that's really at the heart of this book.
Right. I'm sorry, Sophie, I've gone over time. So briefly, is it worth the read? Did it work for you?
Absolutely. My only hesitation is something happens right at the end. I'm not going to give it away, but it becomes very melodramatic, yeah. and the plot rushes forward far too fast to get to an ending, and it loses much of the nuance that's built up beautifully on its way. And I wonder, was that part of the fault of the cost of the publishers pushing the date forward? But definitely, this is one to be read.
One to be read, says Sophie Gormer to us about The Pull of the Stars by Emma Donoghue, which is published by Picador. That's our lot for this evening. Gar Duffy on sound, Janice Furphy, the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's programme produced by Ola McGowan and Keshi.